Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the unofficial CEO of Red Sox Nation, CNN's John King, describes the possible shutdown deal in D.C. But aren't they just kicking the proverbial can you know where? Then it's 6 months since the marathon bombings. We'll take a look at the good and bad of Boston Strong. Then, is it time to bring back home ec? The answer in this studio is yes.
Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane on the shutdown and debt ceiling, plus the great American white-collar crime, the horrible, worthless, boring office meeting, two scholars on the continuing war against women, and Reverend Minyard Culpepper and Charlotte Gorla Ritchie on the Boston mayor's race. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
Today in D.C., as you probably know, the House is outlining alternatives to the Senate's fiscal deal, but do either have enough votes to end this interminable embarrassment? And no conversation with John King is complete, obviously, without talking about his Red Sox, which we will do before he leaves. He joins us every Tuesday at noon, and he's the chief national correspondent for CNN. Hello, John King.
So we're going to save the best for last.
We are. We want to have something to look forward to, John.
It's like opening Al Capone's safe by Geraldo, John. Same deal.
There's nothing good happening here. So, okay.
Well, let's get the depressing stuff out of the way first, because I am getting really depressed, as many Americans are, about this whole thing. But the word is that a deal is near to get us away from this cliffhanger and to end this government shutdown. What's the deal, and will it actually happen?
I hate to be the skunk at the garden party, but don't believe that. There are a lot of talks, and there's a lot more progress than there has been in the past, but there's no deal. The Senate still does not have a deal between Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid that they're prepared to bring to the floor. They say they're very, very close, but they said that yesterday. And part of this optimism is by design, and they are to be credited for that, I guess. They are talking optimistically on purpose so they don't tank the financial markets. But they don't have a deal yet, and they don't have a deal in the Senate until they have a deal. And here's even more depressing news. House Republicans came up with their own alternative proposal today that I'll say was a little bit more to the right of the Senate deal. It delayed that tax on medical devices, for example, in Obamacare. Took a little bigger slice, still a modest slice, but took a little bit more out of Obamacare than the Senate plan does. And guess what? That just collapsed within the last few minutes. House Speaker John Boehner took it to his conference, and those same Tea Party members we've been talking about for 2+ weeks now said, no, it's not tough enough. We won't vote for it. So the House Republicans can't resolve their own differences, and the Senate deal is still tentative, not quite ready to put ink to paper yet. Are they making progress? Yes. Will they get there by, the Wednesday, Thursday deadline? Huge question mark.
So, John, I don't understand then. If it turns out there's a, let's call it a more moderate proposal that is being at least discussed in the Senate, a more conservative proposal in the House doesn't even make it through the Republican caucus. What is the thinking? Let's assume McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, and Harry Reid, the Democratic leader of the Senate, strike a deal, and let's assume it even gets more than a handful of Republican votes, 65 votes. Why does anyone think that that would ever make it through the House of Representatives?
Well, there's no reason to think a Senate deal would make it through the House of Representatives untouched, unless you add in this, and I don't believe this, but the betting in Washington the last 48 hours has been the Senate cuts a deal, they pass it either Wednesday or Thursday. They send it over to the House, and the deadline is either here or has passed, but there's no panic yet because there's a deal being processed and the Treasury does have some money in reserves. And Speaker Boehner just feels so much political pressure and so much economic pressure that he just brings it to the floor and it passes with a majority that includes mostly Democrats and, 20, 30, 40 Republicans. Well, the Speaker's still not prepared to do that. He is still looking for something that gets him a majority of votes among Republicans and averts a, internal revolution. And at the moment, he doesn't have that. Now, does that mean this could be completely changed? He also has a dossier of new polls showing that more than 70% of the American people, blame the Republicans here. And sure, people blame everybody in Washington, but Republicans are taking a huge political hit here at what should be a good time for them. The Speaker knows that, but he is simply unable to convince what some call the Suicide Caucus. We could call them other things. But these guys who say they're standing on principle just won't budge because they want more.
Hey, John, you're talking to two people who are different on one issue in one way. Marjorie's a pretty religious person. I'm an agnostic. However, we both are appalled when religion finds its way into politics. Is it true that before this Republican caucus this morning, the Republicans were singing Amazing Grace, or is that real?
I don't know that. It wouldn't surprise me. I left the building for a couple hours because I was in early this morning, and so I'm doing my reporting by email. There's no audio in my email, so I did not get any recording of Amazing Grace if it was funny this morning. The one thing I would say, I'm making a joke about this, but the one thing I would say about this is that each of these groups should be allowed to conduct their business as they see fit. At some point, and we've talked about this in the past, this is John King speaking, that if you run to join a legislature, which is what the United States Congress is, you can run as a protest candidate. You can run saying, I'm going to Washington to jump in front of the spending train. And if you get reelected, you have the support of the people back home. But legislatures work by, sometimes we make things way too complicated. Legislatures work by the most simple math there is, arithmetic. Can you get a majority? Can you pass your plan? And so now you have, what I'll call more reasonable Republicans, and that's probably not the right term either, more experienced Republicans, trying to tell these House guys, look, the way to change Obamacare is to win more elections. If we keep the government shut down, we're not going to have much luck in the next election. So you're actually defeating, you're actually hurting your cause by doing this. But at the moment, they're not listening.
Well, you know what to me is, and I think to a lot of Americans is really scary. The stock market is already taking a slide, and people are losing confidence. And you hear people like the Treasury Secretary Liu talking about, we have this great reputation when things go south around the world financially. The flight to safety is to go to the U.S. markets, but we're risking our whole reputation. You hear guys like Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan say, as we get closer to this debt ceiling deadline, the panic will set in and something will happen. And everybody seems to be predicting. I know it won't happen immediately, but this is a very, very bad thing for us financially. And you wonder about the long-term damage to people's confidence in the United States economy around the world.
And there's a general bipartisan majority, whether you're talking about folks on Wall Street who support both Democrat and Republicans, whether you're talking about economists who have been in Republican or Democratic administrations, and even among the political, I'll call them the political elite here in Washington, whether they're members of Congress or people who are former members who are around in the lobbying community or the consulting community, who agree with that, who agree that the good faith and credit of the United States, you just can't cross that line. If you cross it by 6 or 8 or 24 hours, as long as there's a deal in the works, okay, it doesn't look good, but it's not a catastrophe. Here's the problem, though, Jim and Marjorie. There are a number of these newly elected in the last 2 to 4 years House members. You can count Ted Cruz and Mike Lee among them on the Senate side, to a degree Rand Paul, although a little less so. And there are supporters back home, and that's millions of people. Well, let's not discount this. These are millions of people who have voted to support these people who don't believe that, who think that the establishment is lying to them, that this is the same group of people who caused the financial crisis back in 2008 and 2009, got bailed out by the taxpayers, and now they're telling you the same thing so that they get their way again. Are they right? I'm not smart enough to do the economics here. Do a lot of people I've known for 20 years say this could be a catastrophe? Yes, they do. Do I respect those people? Yes, I do. Are they right? I don't know. But there are voters out there, and now politicians in Washington, who think the media is lying to them, the Treasury Department's lying to them, the banks are lying to them, and that there would not be a catastrophe.
John, when I listen to you in the last couple of minutes, I keep saying to myself, I really hope they cut a deal. Really, I can't imagine them not cutting a deal. But then when I step back from it and read the outlines of at least what was purportedly in the Senate thing, the best it does, even if they get it through the Senate and then get some variation on it through the House, is the proverbial, as I said at the open, kicking the can down the road. Where what, by December 13th or something, they have to do what they've never been able to do, which is work out some budgetary and tax compromises. So the reality is the best we're going to do is postpone the pain. Is that not a fair statement?
That's exactly right. And guess what? We could use a welcome respite, I guess. And maybe this time they'll actually talk the week after the deal instead of waiting until the week of the deadline again. But we know from the last 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of these mini budget crises that they haven't done that. Budgeting by Band-Aid gets you nothing but a couple of weeks. And that's what we've been doing. And look at this. Are the issues going to get any easier? No. Medicare, Social Security, tax reform, are any of those issues going to get any easier? No. But the politics are going to get even more difficult because what they're talking about is extending government funding through early January, raising the debt ceiling through early February. That's January 2014, February 2014. We're in the election year.
Right.
These Republicans who are nervous now are going to be looking over their right shoulder thinking, am I going to get a primary challenge? If you think kicking this can down the road 3 or 4 months makes it easier, you're nuts.
You know, we're talking with John King from CNN. John, the Globe has been running this great series called Broken Cities, and they had a piece, I think it was yesterday or the day before, talking about Barack Obama's lack of schmoozing, which I found phenomenal, talking about how in 5 years in office, Obama's met with Minority Leader Mitch McConnell just twice.
Alone.
Right. That there was a year and a half span between his first meeting with John Boehner and his second meeting with John Boehner, that Obama's visited blue states 6 times more than visiting states, hasn't been back to South Carolina since 2008. It goes on and on and on. The point being that Barack Obama is sitting back literally in his ivory tower, not getting out there and schmoozing these people. And you wonder whether he's learned anything from this and maybe we'll do a little bit more seducing of the Republican opposition between now and the end of his term, because he's not going to look good in the history books, even though the Republicans now are getting more of the blame. He can't get it done.
Look, he loses here even if he wins, meaning in the short term, you know, he's being blamed less. And if there is a collapse in the markets, you can bet the Republicans will be blamed more. And the president is a good communicator and he has the power of the bully pulpit, and he'll heap even more blame on them. So he will, quote unquote, win in the short term politically. But he's losing. Guys, remember the State of the Union address? It was in February. He wanted to pass a jobs program,
right,
create an infrastructure bank, reform immigration, deal with Medicare and Social Security, raise the minimum wage, guarantee preschool to every child in America. I could go on through next week's program. And guess what? None of those things. Read the speech. None of them has been done. The first year of his second term is over. It's not all his fault, but as a CEO and as a leader, we thought after the election he would do more of this. You listed the Republican meetings and the Republican outreach. The Democrats complain just as much about this president.
Yeah,
they say he doesn't invite them down. That he, when they call and say, you know, I got a great constituent coming in, can I get a White House tour? You know, it takes forever to get even little things like that, small favors done. It's not his style. He is, this is not a criticism, this is who he is. He is a detached intellectual law professor who became a politician. He's never been a governor or a CEO, and that's the part that's been hard to him. If you talk to the Bill Daley, used to be his chief of staff, Eric Schmidt of Google, a huge fan of President Obama, CEOs who like him and respect him, even they come away sometimes saying that's the part of the job that he has not quite figured out in their view, how to bring people together, how to schmooze, whether it's golfing, whether it's a dinner. You can't ask the guy to do things he doesn't want to do. But if he wants his own legacy to be improved,
right?
Again, he didn't shut down the government. He didn't bring us to this point. I'm not blaming the president for, you know, deciding because we don't have the votes to block Obamacare, we're going to, you know, sit in front of the train and cry. but at some point, he knows this environment. This is not a surprise to him, but this is the environment he lives in. And so could he and should he do more to try? I think he would look even better in the eyes of the American people now if they had seen over the past 6 months an effort to deal with this months ago, not at the last minute.
Hey, last shutdown slash default question. Everybody knows, speaking of State of the Union, I think it was two states of the union ago, or maybe it was the last one, Barack Obama proposed or at least said he'd be willing to entertain a means test on Medicare. We know that he has embraced, even if reluctantly, the so-called chain CPI, slowing down the inflation adjustment to Social Security benefits. If a Republican leader sits across the table from Barack Obama and says, okay, President, let's start with the two things that you have already agreed to, even though many in your party can't stand either of them. What does the president say to that Republican leader?
Well, I think the president's actually still willing to have those conversations, whether it's raising the retirement age or doing some means testing, a grand bargain or a, you know, less than grand bargain now because you can't maybe get it all done given the political environment. I think the president still wants to do that. This deal they're setting up for creates an environment where that is again possible. I say again possible because that was what was supposed to happen after the sequester, right? They were going to have these forced budget cuts. They were going to be so painful, it would force them to sit down and figure out a better way to do it. Well, they didn't do it. The time before that, they had another Band-Aid that was supposed to force them to sit down and figure out how to do it, and they didn't do it. So in this deal, again, you're going to get the president and the Democrats back at the table with their good friend Paul Ryan on the Republican side and Republicans in the Senate who want to do those things. And the president will have that opportunity. But again, Jim, that gets you to the point that this is going to be hard any day. Bill Clinton wanted to do this. It was hard. George W. Bush wanted to do this. It was hard. 20-something years later, if you count back to the early Clinton days, it's hard for Barack Obama, and the math is getting worse demographically, and he'll be in the election year when his Democratic base is going to be saying, don't do this, Mr. President. Don't do this, Mr. President. Don't do this, Mr. President.
Okay, so John King, you've been very patient. You sound a little bit down in the dumps, so we have, I think, the cure for what ails you.
Bases loaded. Two out. Hard hit into right. Back at the wall. Tie game! Big Poppy! The grand slam!
You may be familiar with that sound. I'm not sure. So you weren't at the game, correct?
Yes, I was.
You
were.
Were you contemplating leaving before, considering they had no hits? You stayed to the bitter end.
I was texting a good friend of mine who kept saying it's over, and I kept saying, shut up, we're going to win tonight. And then I started to get a little bit nervous, but I had my son with me, who's now 20 years old, so he's a big boy at Boston College. And he used some words in a happy tone that, you know, I'm not supposed to ever let your child speak. But, it was a happy expletive-filled rant. Let's just put it that way. So. I let him get it out of his system. It was amazing. It was. I've been at Fenway for some amazing nights, but that was hopefully a series changer and an energy changer, and hopefully Mr. Verlander gets the Big Poppy treatment today too.
How do you deal with this afternoon? 3 o'clock is the game, and I assume 3 o'clock is when this is all going to be coming to a head if it does over there on Capitol Hill. How do you deal with that? What do you have, a transistor radio? What do you do?
You have priorities, right? I have to do my job, but you know, in an odd way here, maybe I should be thankful that I know they're so dysfunctional, that they're so unlikely to get anything done that I can, you know, keep one eye on the TV set. You learn to multiprocess in this work.
You know, John, I was down at Fenway yesterday doing a story for the Herald about everybody's euphoria, and it was just unbelievable. The game wasn't there, obviously. It was over, but people came back to buy souvenirs. They were up and down Yawkey Way, and people were talking about, you know, the dishwasher's broken, you know, I can't pay the mortgage, I can't stand my wife, but I don't care because I'm on a 3-day high from more teas from the night before. It was just, the spirit was unbelievable. It got me excited.
Hey, you know what? You guys should be happy and proud, because this is not a joke. In the two games this weekend, one of which was depressing and one of which was exhilarating beyond belief, I honestly can't count the number of people who came up to me and said hello, and said they listen to me on Jim and Marjorie every Tuesday.
Love that, John King.
Oh,
it was
John.
Great. It was actually great. It was a lot of fun, and I spent some time talking to them, and I lied and told them how great you guys are.
We lie and tell people how great you are, too, so it's perfect symmetry there.
Yeah. No, it was really nice. It was really nice. And, you know, I know you guys not that long ago moved and all that, but you should be really happy. There's a good group of people out there, and they're fun people, and they love you guys.
Great.
Terrific.
John, you're sweet to say it. John King, CNN. We will talk to you next Tuesday. And, of course, go Sox. See you, John.
John. Amen. Take care, guys.
John King joins us every Tuesday at noon. He is CNN's chief national correspondent and obviously a big Red Sox fan. When we come back, we're going to look at how Boston Strong has become a feeble and over-commercialized phrase 6 months after the Boston Marathon bombing. The conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Months after the Boston Marathon bombings, we've had time to sort through what happened.
Just the whole shootout was pretty wild. Bullets were flying everywhere. Every one of these houses got hit by something.
And examine unanswered questions.
My officers were, you know, in that gunfight, so I'm really not sure until we piece everything together exactly what happened and when it happened.
I'm Philip Martin. Join us for a focus on the Boston Marathon bombings 6 months later. This week on WGBH Radio, WGBH2, and WGBHnews.org.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Boston Conservatory, presenting a special autism-friendly performance of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma, providing a safe, sensory-friendly, and judgment-free theater experience for families. bostonconservatory.edu. And Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru Forester with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It came on almost as quickly as the ambulances, which rushed to the finish line. Last spring, in the immediate aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombings, the phrase, Boston Strong. Now, obviously, it's been 6 months today since the bombings killed three people, injured hundreds more. What does Boston Strong mean? Not long after the bombing, linguist Ben Zimmer wrote in the Globe, the words, we are Boston Strong, allows sympathetic outsiders to take part in a show of strength. It's a rhetorical trope that lets everyone identify with Boston's special kind of strong. But at what point did, I don't know, sympathy give way to sentimentality, to self-aggrandizement, to commercial opportunism? Let us know what you think at 877-301-8970. If you were among the marathon victims, how do you feel when you hear the phrase? Are you an outsider who thinks Boston Strong creates a certain sense of solidarity? Or are you a cynic? Does Boston Strong mean anything to you anymore at 877-301-8970? You know, Ben Zimmer in that same piece, Marjorie, also said perfectly, it's a handy shorthand. This is right after the bombings, for defiance, solidarity, and caring. Then it became a slogan on a T-shirt. But like that Emerson College T-shirt, those two students,
yeah.
Every single penny went to one fund. And then candle companies, fast food companies are marketing Boston Strong material and cheeseburgers and whatever. But the worst and most egregious use that I've heard of this, which puts me totally over
what?
The edge, is when a team in Boston, a professional team, loses a tough game and one of the announcers say, don't worry, Boston Strong will be back tomorrow. It's just, you know, when you watch people like Emily Rooney, who's done these, followed Roseanne Sedoya.
Great interviews.
Unbelievable
yes.
interviews. The great piece on Mark Fukeril by Sarah Schweitzer in the Globe. Peter Galzinis with that story about the woman who's a dancer who said she'll dance again. I think it's Adrienne Haslett Davis, I think is her name. When you read those, you say, that's what this is about. And when you see a candle or a double cheeseburger or whatever it is, using Boston Strong purely to make money or pump their brand name, for lack
right.
of a better, it really makes my blood run cold.
Well, it's also become sort of ubiquitous, too. Live Strong was the Lance Armstrong
sure.
thing, and of course that's, you know, Armstrong, Live Strong. I didn't know this, but Hurricane Irene, I Am Vermont Strong, Jersey Strong after Sandy, Country Strong, Brittany Hoover's a country album. Apparently this happened in the Bruins game, Boston Strong, Toronto Stronger.
Oh, no, a fan in Toronto,
yeah.
during, I think, the playoffs held up, and it created this huge firestorm in social media. That was also totally inappropriate.
Did you read the one about Cambridge?
No, what's
yeah,
this?
That was Boston Strong, Cambridge Smart. So there's become this whole thing where it's kind of become almost a cliche, I guess. And part of you thinks, what does it really mean? You know,
well, I think the original.
Really,
I think what Ben Zimmer said originally, this notion, defiance, caring, all
right.
those things. I was totally moved by that. Not just, by the way, the strength of the people who suffered themselves, but their families, their supporters, the people who rushed, the first responders,
right.
the Carlos Arredondos.
But there was a little bit of it that Boston Strong and New York is not, or Boston Strong and, you know, California is not. I mean, are we unique?
Yeah, there was a piece of that, but I have to say, I was okay with that. What really, when it started entering the commercial realm, and you'd hear terms like, for example, Yankee Candle says net proceeds, whatever that mean, of our Boston Strong candle go to one fund. You know, enough already. If you want to show your solidarity, make a huge contribution either to one fund or something else.
Well,
it's in many ways crossed the, at least in my estimation, it has crossed the line and become far too commercialized and far.
Well, it's the same sort of problem many people have, including women who are breast cancer survivors, about the ubiquitous pink.
I know you
and,
hate it.
And breast cancer awareness month, and you might have seen people that were at the Gillette Stadium. There were pink sneakers on the field and pink ribbons on people's lapels, and you know, that's one thing because it's a solidarity sort of thing. But when you go to every store and everything is pink at whichever mall you go to, somehow the feeling isn't quite right.
Well, yeah, it isn't. But I want to temper that by saying if it is true. Well, I don't know if I even believe this. I was going to say if it's true that 100% of everything goes to a good cause, that's one thing. But the flip side of that is not, and I don't mean to paint with as broad a brush as I'm about to. Let's assume a particular product of a company, 100% of that product's Boston Strong sale goes to either One Fund Boston or something else. There's another benefit they accrue is it helps their whole company name. So while they're doing something allegedly out of a spirit of generosity, they a huge benefit accrues to them too. And it's just, I don't want to hear any of this commercial. I loved it when it first happened. I actually like it a lot when it's applied to things that it should be applied to. But beyond that, particularly on the 6 month anniversary of today, it really drives me crazy. 877-301-8970 is our phone number.
You wonder if it's really about, you know, Boston Strong and what that means about people healing and being together, or if it's about selling shoelaces.
Because no, I know. It's true.
Strong shoelaces. And we're not sure how much of the proceeds from the shoelace sales actually go to the one fund or go to the shoelace company. Anyway, Jeff from Brighton, thanks for calling Boston Public Radio. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, I remember when everything first, you know, came out, there was, I feel like there was two expressions that were going around. There was also, there was Boston Strong, and then there was this We Are One Boston.
Right.
And that one really struck a chord with me. We were living, you know, in a predominantly African-American part of town at the time. And I remember just thinking about, you know, the history of segregation in Boston and the idea that this is something that we can all rally around, that everybody is sort of like, we are one in this situation. You know, there's no black, white, there's no, you know, all the different various segregations that have happened in Boston weren't there. And I feel like that's a shame that that one didn't catch on as much as Boston Strong did.
Well, Jeff, can I half agree with you and half not? In the immediate aftermath, I think your description is exactly right. But the whole question about We Are One Boston, we discussed this with the 11 mayoral candidates who showed up and with the governor and with virtually everybody else. There was a lot of feeling, at least in some sectors of communities of color in Boston, particularly when at the Blackstonian,
well,
has been documenting one shooting a day since April 15th.
It wasn't just the black communities that felt that way, but go ahead.
I mean, what do you mean? Does that mean lower?
I think a lot of white communities felt a little funny about it too. But
the notion that Boylston Street and what happened on Boyle Street was getting one level of response and concern and financial support, and a mother who lost a kid to shooting an innocent kid in Roxbury wasn't getting it, and that maybe in that regard we weren't one Boston. Jeff, thank you kindly for the phone call. But it is true. It's sort of in the immediate aftermath, what Jeff described, I think was a wonderful feeling growing out of it, one of the most horrific things you can imagine coming out of Boston.
Kathy from Salem. What do you think, Kathy?
I think that it's inspirational. It will help others going forward if they're ever in a horrendous situation like this. I think it had to have helped the victims, although I don't pretend to speak for them. I did see a show on their recovery process last night, and as somebody who's in the medical profession, I was amazed at the progress that's been made by the victims of the bombings. And I think it's all good. Pretend it didn't happen. Pretend there was no Boston Strong. What would have happened if there was no interest, nobody rallying around them?
But, Kathy, let me be clear, and I think I'm speaking for Marjorie here. Neither of us are suggesting that that spirit was not important, hugely important, and remains important if directed at what matters, the people who suffered and the people who love them and vice versa. Our concern, at least we're trying to bring it up as an issue, is sort of the crass either commercialization. Well, again, the thing that put me totally over the edge was hearing some announcer on one of our pro teams in town saying that, don't worry, they lost tonight, but they'll come back tomorrow because Boston's strong. I mean, it just doesn't, for me at least, it doesn't work. Kathy, thank you for the call. You know, by the way, speaking of the people who either lost a limb or suffered grievous injuries, you know, not only is it amazing 6 months after when you hear these stories about personal strength, that to me
the one that ran the marathon, I think
the
Herald had a story about her. No, she ran a whole marathon.
Oh, was?
5 hours. It took her a while, almost 6 hours, but she did it, and she did not lose a leg, but she had a lot of shrapnel in her leg.
Yeah, but
it was incredible.
I was reading your colleague Peter Galzinis' story on this woman who was a dancer.
Oh, yes.
A week after, on April 22nd, I think, you know, forget having hope and being optimistic or whatever, having this positive spirit 6 months later, if you're on the mend, but the level of strength that these people have shown, starting almost on day one, is just
right.
It's unthinkable to
but
me.
There is another angle on this too, and I happen to have talked to one woman who did lose her leg for a piece I wrote for the Herald, who said, you know, one of the problems of this is many of us don't feel very strong. Mm. And, you know, there's sort of this, okay, everybody's going to be strong, everybody's going to be cheerful, everybody's going to move along. And many people do.
I mean, those who are victims.
Yes, but some people don't. Mm-hmm. This is not, they're not feeling they've lost a leg.
Oh, I know.
You know, and it's almost like the cancer thing where, you know, you hear a lot of women say, you know, you have to fight, you have to fight, you have to fight, you got to be a fighter. And as if you're not a fighter, then somehow you're not dealing the right way with your disease.
Yeah,
so
but
those things
I tell you,
are very fraught.
I agree, but I have to say, I think the press, with very few exceptions, has done a brilliant job of having its feet in both of those things, that there is hope and optimism on some day. I mean, I mentioned to you without naming his name, I was visiting a friend of both of ours at Spalding about a month or two after, and I was sitting with him and we're talking, and obviously a huge number of the marathon victims were there, and the cameras are off. And the reporters, the Marjorie Egans, the Galzinises, the Emily Rooneys are not there at this point. And it is a whole different world. But it can be both, I guess, is the point. And to that, I guess, it applied. Let's go to Frank. You're in Burlington. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Frank.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
Well,
you're on.
I meant to be down there that day. I wanted to bring my nieces down there for their first time, but I had a doctor's appointment, and they had, you know, things going on with their girlfriend. So I ended up staying in the hospital that day, thank God, because if I was there, you know, I don't think I could deal with seeing what happened there. I mean, I work in home health care and all, mm-hmm. but just actually, I've never seen, you know, like what happened to those people.
Yeah.
I watched the program on last night where they had 150 people there on ABC, you know, where the Chronicle time slot was.
Yep.
So, you know, I watched that and I was like crying my eyes out, like I was, you know, just listening to the stories and what the people went through and, you know,
and
the
continue
recovery
to go
process.
Through, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like the firstborn son of Egypt, you know. I've had diabetes since I was 2 years old. I've had it 41 years and I'm 44 now. You know, and it's just like I've suffered my whole life. But, you know, you have to go on no matter what. You know, my family is the one that pushes me on.
Well, I think, by the way, the families of a lot of these people who suffered a lot and have kept them going, and I think the support for the most part of the community has been spectacular. Frank, thank you for your contribution that we appreciate.
And there was a great piece over the weekend, I forget where I read it, about, you know, that there's a lot of pain here, too. I mean, a lot of physical pain people are dealing with. So, you know, to not to pretend that you can lose a leg and then just go blithely on, and the prosthetic devices, you know, need to be refitted, and they need to be, you need to get new ones, and the whole thing. I mean, it's a big deal. I always worry that we sometimes in our rush to talk about Boston Strong, somehow don't want to hear about the real horror that these people have to go through to heal. Anyway.
Robert Brookline, you're next with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for your call. Hi, Robert.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
The thing that I really kind of think about is that a while back they had these terrible T-shirts that, I'm going to get bleeped here, but there was the Yankees Sucks T-shirts.
Oh, yes.
And I think you guys are kind of bringing it into that level in which it had its 15 minutes of fame and that was it. You know, it was gone, especially when we won the World Series. But it's not like that neighbor with this Christmas wreath on the door in the middle of July. You know, it's still strong. It's still people coming together, and you saw these people out in the middle of the athletic field walking and being with personal trainers and being with athletic trainers, and it was just a beautiful thing. And the last film really wrapped it up great. You know, he's gone through his entire life. You know, it's strong.
Yeah, but it can be, Robert, I guess, but it doesn't have to be one thing or the other. What you're describing, the human strength and resilience, is absolutely what you describe. But at the same time, when you see on the six-month anniversary, people trying to make a buck off this concept with, at least in my estimation, very little, if any, concern for what you're talking about, I think it's fair to take that on. But, Robert, thank you. We appreciate your call.
Okay, when we come back, we are going to change gears here and look at curricula that the mayoral candidates should consider when they talk about school reform. We're talking about home economics. Home economics, Jim.
I know it.
Is it time to bring it back to the classroom? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
In a lot of places, college isn't always what comes after high school.
I don't think college is for everybody because you can go and waste a lot of money and not know what you're going to do. I mean, it's our life. We can do what we want.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, trying to get more kids in school nonetheless. That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And 4 centuries of Massachusetts furniture, where you can see extraordinary furniture made in Massachusetts from the 1600s to the present at museums and cultural institutions throughout the state. Details at 4centuries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Well, if it weren't for home economics, this may surprise you. We may never have known the likes of Grover, of Bert, Ernie, Kermit. That's because Jim Henson, the man behind the Muppets, obviously majored in home economics. A recent piece in the Boston Globe makes the case to bring home ec back. While we are all obsessed about math and science and similar things, should we make room for sewing, carpentry, cooking, even balancing a checkbook? Joining us on the line is a home ec advocate who knows we'd benefit if we knew where our food came from, how to prepare it. She's Alice Lichtenstein. Alice is a senior scientist and director of cardiovascular nutrition laboratory at Tufts Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging. Alice, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be with you.
So tell us, Alice, because I'm really with you on this one, why do we need to bring back, or why should we bring back home economics in 2013? And what should that mean in 2013?
Well, I think in 2013, it should mean hunting and gathering the 21st century, that we really need to teach children of the foods that are available and what's commonly available in the supermarket, how can they select foods that are going to end up providing a healthy diet, and try to give them some skills so they're not intimidated to the point where they don't think they have the capacity to actually prepare food and that they have to default to fast food restaurants.
And by the way, for the backdrop for this is, I assume people know that roughly a third of young people are either overweight or obese in 2013. Is anybody doing this? When I read this piece, I think Marjorie had the same reaction. You're quoted in the Boston Globe. It's sort of like, of course this makes sense. Of course this should be done. Are school systems doing this, or are we too packed with preparing for standardized tests and similar things?
Well, it's not a required course. It may be available in some schools, and I think what it needs to be is required for both girls and boys. And it doesn't necessarily need to take up a tremendous amount of time, because for certain things, like calculating how many calories you need and how many calories you burn off during exercise, well, that can be done in math class. In economics class, children can be taught whether it's worth buying the large package of cereal or whether it's more cost effective to buy the smaller one. So it's really the only unique time that needs to be sequestered would be that for actual preparation of food, just basic food skills that kids are not necessarily getting at home as used to, the situation used to be.
Hey, Alice Lichtenstein, you used the word sequester and it just got me to think, are you affected by the current mess, the shutdown?
Unfortunately, I am, because I work at the Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging. We do not have access to the building or our offices, so I'm actually working off-site, but at Tufts.
Well, thank you. Okay, so Alice, is there any hard evidence that if you do teach a young kid how to select food, how to count calories, how to cook, that sort of stuff, that it leads them away from the garbage that most of us ate as children and they do? Is there any hard data on that?
Not that I'm aware of, and part of that is the challenge that there's not a lot of research money available, and one would need to get research dollars in order to do a study like this.
You know, maybe I'm being too grandiose here, Alice, but I think it should be cooking. I think it should be basic sewing, like how to sew a hem and how to sew a button. It should be maybe a little bit of parenting, too. I mean, I know we're worried about the math and science all the time and stuff, and you think you're going to learn these things from your parents. But do we still learn all these things from our parents, especially when mom's working, dad's working, everybody's exhausted, it's easier to throw something in the microwave than cook dinner? Do we learn these things anymore? I'm not sure we do.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why David Ludwig and I wrote a commentary in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, a couple years ago, because it appears that children are not actually getting these skills from home. And even for throwing something in the microwave, you don't know how to, you don't need to know how many minutes. You can just hit a button that says popcorn. And you know, but certainly for things like sewing on a button, it's really, it's a travesty to say, well, button falls off of a shirt, I need to replace it.
Exactly.
But you know, it's also, you know, we have different foods in the supermarket than we once did. So we've got bags of baby carrots. Well, you know, it might be a good idea to point that out and show kids that that could be a good snack with hummus, and that it doesn't always take a very long time to prepare a meal. Because if you buy boneless, skinless chicken breasts on sale, then you can do a stir-fry very quickly.
We're going to take your calls in a minute. By the way, Alice Lichtenstein, the name of the piece that she and her colleague wrote for the 2010 Journal of the American Medical Association was what we're talking about, Bring Back Home Economics. And when you talked about kids, people not knowing how long something should be in a microwave, I'm reminded, and I know it's off subject, of a Woody Allen movie when he said when he was really hungry and had a frozen TV dinner, if he couldn't wait to cook it, he'd just lick it frozen. So, Alice, I don't know why it's stuck in my... Alice, before we let you go, when you wrote this thing with this, was it David Ludwig? Is that his name?
Yes.
When you wrote this piece with Ludwig, what kind of response, it was 3 years ago, what kind of response did you get?
Well, I got a tremendous amount of positive response from the community. Unfortunately, the systems are not necessarily in place to make some real change. And I think that's where the challenge really is. It's going to take public pressure, and I think it's going to take pressure from parents who view this as an important skill that their children should get, and then some very creative thinking on how to incorporate it into the current curriculum. And there is the Association for Consumer Science, Family and Consumer Science, that has some very good curricula that could be picked up and used almost immediately. But each school system handles things differently. So I think it's going to really be grassroots support from the parents that are going to make the real change.
You know, I wonder, Alice, is the reason we got rid of home economics because of the dispute, you know, the girls get stuck in home economics and the boys
shop.
go to shop, or they go to woodworking or something. Was it about that? Was it about the rise of the feminist movement in the 70s? How come it
went? Well, I'm not sure about that, because we got rid of shop also. I think some of it may have had to do with the expansion of the curriculum, that there were other subjects that were thought to be very important.
Yeah.
And for some reason, there was an under-recognition that just basic food preparation skills are really extremely important. And it's not that somebody even has to necessarily follow a recipe, but it just sort of basic things about cutting up vegetables and sauteing them and then putting the protein source in, or, you know, or how to just buy things in a supermarket.
Alice Lichtenstein, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, you guys can weigh in now what you think about this at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. I am so with this.
So am I.
Because I feel
so
I fail totally as a mother. My children don't know how to sew a hem. They don't know how to sew on a button. You know, I don't know how to cook that well. I couldn't teach them how to cook that well. And I learned... I remember this, in sixth grade, how to sew by hand. It is probably one of the most useful things I've ever learned, because when things fall apart at the seams, you know, I have a lot of holes in my clothes, Tim, as you pointed out over the years.
I have noticed that, yes.
I can sew them back together. I can even sew a moth hole. How about that?
That's fabulous. You know, I'm totally with her, too. 877-301-8970. And there are many reasons. You know, as I said, one-third of young people are overweight and obese, and you heard Alice Lichtenstein say essentially what skills they could learn. How many kids, think of your own kids, think of your three, my two, can any of them balance a checkbook? What's a
helpless
checkbook?
Helpless.
They can't do that basic skill. Sew on a button. I agree. The one-step solution is home ec. And by the way, in this piece, they mention that they're talking, I think Alice did this too, change the name of home ec, because it's laden with so many, whatever, gender things that upset people, that in this piece, I can't remember what they came up with another name essentially to do the same mm-hmm. thing. But it's essentially, it's a course on practical skills.
Yeah, boys,
you teach
boys
young people.
Boys go too, exactly.
Of course they do.
Boys turn out to be great chefs. A lot of the great chefs are boys, or men, I should say. And what boy doesn't want to be able to sew a button on a
you
shirt?
You didn't answer my question. Can any of your three kids balance a checkbook?
I think they can now balance a checkbook. But
you're not sure.
Well, I've showed them whether they're actually
doing it.
Frankly, they don't balance a checkbook. They go online and they look
see
at
what their balance
accounts.
Is.
That's what they do. They go online, so they're not sitting
Oops,
there with a checkbook.
Oops, I forgot I have a $300 checkout stand.
Yeah, like I am. Like we learn when we're young, but none of my kids know how to sew. And like I said, you know, clothes fall apart, Jim.
So
you want to keep your clothes for 30 years. You need to know how to sew a seam.
877-301-8970. Is it time to bring back home ec, or at least a variation on the home ec theme? There are two votes, yes, right here in the studio. Marie, you're in Shrewsbury. How do you vote?
Oh, I vote definitely yes, but here's the kicker. I have a daughter who's a senior in high school, and she said, oh, I'm taking cooking, Mom. And I was like, okay, whatever. I went to open house. Kitchen is gorgeous. It's better than mine. They've got the latest equipment. She's learning. I mean, she's a pretty good cook anyway. But the things that they do in this class are pretty, I mean, it's pretty amazing. And the teacher was surprised because she said, oh, how many parents are here are seniors? My husband and I raised our hand. She goes, oh, never, no one ever comes in on open house because they don't think of it as class. It's one of the best things she's doing. And here's the best part. She's taking Mediterranean cooking next to me.
Oh, excellent. So, Marie, you're set.
Yeah. And I have one other thing. I have a son who's graduating from college. He said, Mom, I have a degree in English. I have read the great works, but I don't know how to live. I don't know how to rent an apartment, write it, balance a checkbook, you know, cook a meal. And I thought, wow. So, Marjorie, I'm a failure, too, as a parent.
Yeah, I feel terrible.
One more shot.
Marie,
that
was a great call.
But you know something, Marie? You know what's great about cooking classes? Because two of my three kids took cooking classes, and what I noticed—
In high school?
Yes. Wow. In high school, they did. And what I noticed after they took the cooking classes was how impeccably— spotless the kitchen was when I said, can you clean up the kitchen for me because I'm going somewhere or whatever or help me out. Unbelievable.
Who were the two? Your two daughters or was your son one of the two?
Daniel.
Really?
Anna and Dan both took cooking classes and neither of them can cook very well. But boy,
they really can clean.
They can clean that kitchen to beat the band. It was a wonderful thing.
Hey, Marie, thanks for a fabulous call to get things started. Let's go to Worcester where Sarah is on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, I just wanted to say that I graduated from college high school a couple of years ago. Home ec was a required class.
Really?
It was required, but we learned how to write a check. We learned how to write cursive. We learned nothing. Like, I had to teach my boyfriend how to do laundry and how to boil water. I taught myself how to sew because I make my own clothes. Like, but this is something, it's basic life skills that you need. I don't know, I learned how to apply for a job, how to fill out tax forms.
That's another great point.
So many people just don't know, and I think
I don't know.
Hey, Sarah, did your fellow students appreciate even if it wasn't the broad enough spectrum of topics, did they appreciate the class or did they resist it?
Oh no, all of us in there, we just joked around. Like even me, it was a joke, and the teacher didn't try. We all just laughed it off, and it didn't matter.
So, can the boyfriend or former boyfriend boil water now?
Yes, he can, and he even knows to put a wooden spoon on top so it doesn't boil over.
I didn't know about that. You put a wooden spoon on top and it doesn't boil over?
Yep, as it gets all foamy on top, it won't boil over. It breaks the surface tension.
Sarah, love that. Thanks for the tip.
A great little,
thank
a
you, Sarah. So she had home ec just a couple years ago.
We're getting some emails from people in their 30s and their 40s that are graduates of home ec classes in school, too.
We're in high school, obviously,
yeah,
right?
Julie from Beverly says she learned about shopping by price and quantity and how to balance a checkbook in elementary school, plus basic sewing, cooking, and woodworking in middle school. So her kids in the generation before them are seriously lacking these skills. Her kids, she means, and she's in her 40s. So there you go. I guess they had it. And the woman before that was Amanda. She said she's in her 30s.
I should be fair. You know, I said my kids, and it's possible my younger one did because my younger is as good as any 19-year-old saying, can you lend me $50? I mean, she really gets the concept. Let's go to Robert in Boston. You were next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Robert.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Excellent.
Well, I'm a product of home ec, but we used to call it life management skills in school.
Life management skills. That is what it is, yeah.
But you know what? It really catered more to men to take these courses. I mean, you learn to scrub the sink with Comet. You know, everything had to sparkle. Nobody could leave. And we were set up in families, as we called it. It was groups of four. We did a checkbook. I cook. My wife can't cook. She can't burn an egg. Or boil water if she tried.
Oh, God.
but her forte was, I mean, she came from a house where her parents wanted her to do this, so reluctantly she didn't.
Yeah.
I took the course. It made me wiser. I mean, I can go to grocery stores and I can decipher stuff a lot quicker based by size, by quantity, how much we need and project it. whether it's Thanksgiving, Christmas, I'm the one that cooks. And I mean, it's a benefit to us because it's my forte, and I wouldn't want her to do it. And it works for us.
I think it's great you had it. Robert, thanks to Cole. Maybe we're wrong, and maybe the Globe woman is wrong, and there's more of this offered in the schools than either we or she was aware of.
Well, the cooking classes that they had at Brookline High School were really pretty nice cooking classes, but they didn't learn anything else. They didn't learn sewing, or they didn't learn balancing a checkbook. Listen to this. Ernie just emailed and said he just hired a new warehouse person 2 years out of high school. Ernie sent him to a supplier with a check, and the kid had to ask how to fill out the check.
Well, I've told you this story. I had a plumber coming to my house who actually, you know, the family a handful of years ago, and he was always, always late, even though he was wonderfully competent and a really good guy. You know what he didn't know how to do? Keep a date book. He had no idea how to keep a schedule. So, I mean, it sounds like you say, what do you mean? You write it down. Well, it just wasn't one of his skills. So he had in his head when you called him, can you come over Wednesday at 8 a.m.? Yeah, I'll be there Wednesday at 8 a.m. When he showed at 9:30, he remembered that it was something about Wednesday. And by the way, he was a very smart guy. He just had what are they called? Executive skills.
Yeah, but they do
teach you.
He had no
executive skills.
They do teach you that in school, study skills.
Well, they didn't teach one. He was probably 35 years old 10 years ago, and they hadn't taught it in his gym. But, you know, it's interesting. This is one of the few topics we ever discuss here with this virtual unanimity. If you've done it, it was really valuable. If you haven't done it, like that first woman who called about one of her children or son or something with the English degree, it's hugely, I mean, it's in demand.
Well, this is another one of those things where they talk about the longer school day, particularly in Boston where they have a very short school day. I mean, these are some of the things you could do in a longer school day.
Life skills.
Day.
I mean,
yes.
They are practical life skills.
I wasn't joking about parenting. I mean, I think lots of people, especially when they're young single moms on their own, have no idea what to do.
And, you know, by the way, you could sneak in like you were auditing it for a column and learn how to balance a checkbook. That's the beauty of being a reporter. You can go to anything and say you're just doing it because you're writing a story.
That's right. Ralph from West Roxbury. What do you think, Ralph?
Yes. You know, I really like what Jim just said about life skills. My wife is a high school teacher in Boston. I won't mention the high school.
Okay.
But she's always telling me about a lot of the skills that students don't have, and these are juniors and seniors. They don't know how to tell time from a regular analog clock.
Oh,
that is, I know that quite well.
You know, she was trying to teach them how to, you know, take pulses and watch the second hand go around the clock. They had no idea they're also used to the digital clocks or watches that they have. They don't know. The previous caller had mentioned cursive writing. She had gone up to the front of the room and on the whiteboard had written something out in cursive writing, and the students didn't know what she had written.
That is unbelievable.
It really is life skills. You know, young women have showed up. You know, they'll arrange for them to have a job interview, and they'll show up at school, you know, first, and they'll be wearing what they think are really beautiful clothes. And they're so very provocative. My wife has actually sent them home.
And yeah, you hear that all the time.
That's a big one.
Change their clothes.
Yeah, that's a big one.
So I think you're getting a basic idea. What the problems are with some of these the urban high schools.
Yeah.
You know they a lot of them are immigrants. And in this particular high school that my wife teaches at, I know it will be hard to believe, but 47%, she told me this the other day, and it just knocked me over, 47% of the kids are categorized as a special education. 47% in a high school in Boston.
Well, that's been a big debate, by the way, since the special ed laws, I guess, of the 90s. Ralph, thank you very much for your call.
You see it in the suburban high schools, too. You just see kids clueless about lots of things. How many times have we talked about...
Oh, I don't think this is socioeconomic yet.
I think
upper middle class kids are as clueless as poor kids in this particular and vice versa.
And clueless about the outfits. I mean, we've had this conversation a million times before. Somebody comes to a job, a young woman who's just out of college, and she looks like she's going to a nightclub. And all the... Well, they do.
Or performing in a nightclub.
You know, and the guys in the office just don't know what to do. They don't know where to look. They don't know what to do. And then they haul in. This happened at my workplace. They had to haul in a very pregnant-looking middle manager female
to have that conversation.
To instruct the young woman that this was not the appropriate dress to wear in the office.
You know, I just very briefly, by the way, Ralph was calling from West Roxbury and his wife was a teacher. We should just mention Marjorie and I had an opportunity to address an assembly of 7th to 12th graders at Roxbury Latin this morning in West Roxbury. I want to thank – it was – We had a hugely wonderful time. I wanted to thank them. It's a great place.
I wonder if they're teaching home economics at Roxbury Latin.
I think they're teaching about everything. 877-301-8970. We'll take one or two more. Linda, you're in Swansea. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
You know, it's little things. Well, not so little things. Like, you know, what happens when you don't pay a bill? That these kids
yeah.
don't feel like.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
Like, why do you not want to carry a balance on your Visa card?
Yeah.
What happens when you overdraw on your debit card? Things like that, they don't even have a clue about that need to be talked about in schools or at home. Well, at home. But if home's not doing it at home.
You know, Linda, you made it. I had not even thought of those. They're sort of, they're like one tier down or over.
Yeah.
There are a million things that young people and not so young people have no idea.
Oh, yeah, the ATM
what to do.
Just gives you more and more
it's
money.
Right.
Don't
it just
you know
keeps
that,
coming
Jim?
Out. Linda, that was great. Thank you
but
much
you know,
for the call.
What I think it's about, at least it was about this with me, is that if you're working a full-time job and you've got small children or even, you know, middle school children, you get home at the end of the day and you are tired.
Exactly.
And a lot of the things that you used to do that mom had a chance to do when mom was there at 2:30. I don't mean to be sexist about it. I mean, dad could do it too, but usually it's the mom. You're just not doing it because it's easier for you just to do it yourself than sit down and teach the kids.
Yeah,
that's kind of sad.
Speaking of sexist, and we mentioned that in our day, there was home ec for girls and there was shop for boys. I remember to this day, I made a puppy head doorstop. I was in shop for, and I mean this.
How adorable.
2 years I was in shop. Not one, but 2 years. The one product of my 2 years of shop was a puppy head doorstop.
Gee, Jim, I wish you'd bring that in and share it with us
puppy
here at WGBX.
It was nice. It was a good one, but it wasn't. It shouldn't have taken 2 years to admit. Even I will be the first.
I'm sure it's fine.
To admit that.
Puppy head doorstep?
I said, no, doorstop.
Doorstop, excuse
yeah.
me. Doorstop.
It's
puppy
fabulous.
Head. Was it heavy, the head, to stop the door?
It was heavy enough. It was heavy enough.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I think we're all in agreement here. It is time to bring back some form of home economics. When we come back, it is time for something else. Open mic with Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. We're going to take on how President Obama should be leading in the face of the government shutdown. And she's also going to tell us what's wrong with the office meeting and what we can do about it to make them more productive. All that up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Here with us on Studio 3, bearing homemade cookies, allegedly made
so
in
impressed.
Her home, is our new addition to Open Mic. She is Nancy Kane. She's a historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is about the great Ernest Shackleton, entitled Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you, Jim. Glad to be here.
Well, we're going to
need a cookie. Can you talk?
Before we get to the business meeting, which I'm so anxious to talk about, Jim has said this is the way we should look at this because you are a business school professor. And if you had the government shutdown as a case study, how would you put it forward to your students and how would you explain it and fix it, et cetera?
So I would say that this is about, you know, to go back to Shackletonian terms, it's about, if you will, the extreme flanks, right, trying to run the show or run the army. And that responsibility, the responsibility to, as Shackleton would say, you know, minimize, right, the damage of the very expensive doubting Thomases, or in this case, the radical wing of the Republican Party, And at the same time, find the public good that is somewhere right to the center of them. That responsibility rests on the leadership in Congress, but it still, in the end, rests more significantly on the shoulders of Barack Obama. Right. And there are all kinds of aspects of this that would go into the case study. You'd have to have a few paragraphs on the 2011 debt ceiling crisis.
Yep.
Right. You'd have to have a paragraph on the failure of the grand bargain. You'd have to have a paragraph on the fact that since April, there's been nothing that has moved out of the budget committees on Capitol Hill, even though this clock has been ticking. Now, why hasn't there been any kind of action earlier? And in response to that, to the, if you will, right, the cliff getting closer and closer. And when I say any action, I'm sure the White House has been busy. I have no doubt that Harry Reid and John Boehner and all kinds of folks in Washington have been working. But the question is, there hasn't been any forward movement. It's a little bit like Shackleton's men trying to drag the ice boats across the ice.
Say who Shackleton is.
This great Antarctic explorer who found himself without GPS and Google Maps and texts, lost and trapped on an iceberg with 27 other men in 1914, 1915, 1916. And his ship went down and he had to somehow get his men to safety. And he tried all kinds of things to do that. But once something didn't work, he tried something else. So we haven't seen that. But the most interesting part of the discussion, I think, would be among the students about if you're a leader in this, you're the top dog in this kind of stage, and you're stymied with lots and lots of different traditional methods of moving a group, what are your alternative roads? And one of them that Obama has and has simply not utilized to anything like fifth gear, I'd say stuck in second with a bad clutch, is going directly to the people.
Well, speaking of directly to the people, I told the story, Marjorie and I were together at an event this morning, about I used to debate for years this woman who was head of the anti-tax movement in Massachusetts, and I represented, I wouldn't say the pro-tax, but the fair tax movement.
You were the pro-tax.
Whatever.
You were the raise your taxes
and
side.
The day I started the job, a guy who subsequently became a congressperson from Western Mass, John Oliver, took me to the editor of the Greenfield Recorder, who was, it's a newspaper out there, sympathetic to my side, but said, you're never going to win. Because people like you, Jim, who believe in government, talk billions and trillions, which means nothing to anybody. Barbara Anderson, the head of Citizens for Limited Taxation, woman is, he said, brings everything down to the barbershop level, meaning at the end of a debate, whether it's true or not, every man and woman in the audience has no idea what you're talking about, at least in how it affects them. And every person knows whether they'll be able to buy one less pizza, not be able to go to the movies. Isn't that where leadership, whether it's Obama or one of the others, has failed? They haven't made it real, the
Absolutely.
Impact for people.
So let's use a historical analogy, since that's the kind of tools of my trade. So let's go back to 1933 and March, and Franklin Roosevelt's just been elected, or inaugurated rather, and there's a banking crisis. Most Americans don't know what a banking crisis is. So Roosevelt gets on the radio and explains the banking crisis and says, by the way, I can assure you that your money, after explaining this, is safer in the bank than under your mattress, thereby quelching, shutting down the possibility or the ongoing panic of bank runs. Obama hasn't even thought, as far as I can tell, I have no indication that he's thought about doing that. When was the last fireside chat, televised conversation that the president had with his fellow, let me underline, fellow citizens of this republic about what was going on and how they could telephone, tweet, Facebook, email their congressman about getting the government working and the American economy running again?
Yeah, but that's a chicken and the egg thing, because we were discussing this with Kelly Bates from Emerson yesterday about how we are one of the least activist societies that we can imagine in the world. Now, you might say it's because leadership is not getting us to be activists, but it seems to me that we are so used to just firing off an email occasionally or doing something like that, that the activism of the American people, even when they're outraged, as they apparently are now, is virtually non-existent.
Again, as a historian of leadership, activism is not something that kind of just springs full-blown, right, from the street of Zeus, from the streets of, Mount Olympus. It is something that is always mixed up and stirred and salted and peppered by someone, whether it's a librarian or a school principal or a town councilman or, someone writing Silent Spring like Rachel Carson. It doesn't just, exist in its own kind of pressure.
So you think it's a leadership failure?
I think it's a leadership failure, but I also think there's lots of good examples of Americans being great activists, whether we're talking about the environmental movement or we're talking about energy conservation under Jimmy Carter or we're talking about women getting into the workforce or we're talking about mothers against drunk driving. Americans can get mobilized, want to get mobilized when they understand why they're being mobilized and how it affects them, and do it.
Well,
so I think there's an element of citizenship here and sleeping. Right. While the boys can't get along in the sandbox in Washington. But there's also an element of lots of people responsible to the polity, responsible to the Democratic nuts and bolts, which are voters of this country, not talking to them about what's going
on. We're talking with Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. You know, you're a professor. Obama was a professor. He's obviously a smart guy. Everybody has complained about his lousy communication skills since he's been there in 2008, or shortly after we realized he'd stopped communicating it in 2008. Why doesn't he get this? I mean, it's just bizarre to me.
It is, and it's anomalous given that in a few extraordinary instances, he's been an astounding communicator directly with us. Think about the speech in the spring of 2008 about race. Remember his
great
kind of
speech.
Firebrand.
Great speech.
Yeah. Astounding speech, not just about race today and all its complexities and what it means to be a black man running for president.
And by the way, he was not president then, for
he
whatever it's worth.
He was not president. No, but he did it brilliantly and poignantly, and he pointed to the past and the present and the future. He did it in the Gabby Giffords kind of speech he delivered right a week after she was shot.
That's a good point.
I've forgotten
that. In
that terrible bloodbath. Yep. He is a great communicator, and I think that afternoon after Sandy Hook, when he stood there in a press room and talked about being a father and these children being killed in a school, public school, was one of the most astounding moments we've seen from an American president about what's important and what this moment means. So he has the goods to do this. I don't understand it. But I think this is a really powerful arsenal that he's not going to hear. Not going to.
I think the key way to get a big rally going is to bring your cookies, because I just had a chocolate chip. I would come
to
a rally for anything.
Eating on
well,
the
you're
air
talking. But can I stay on the case study thing just for 1 minute before we get to meetings? So a board of directors meeting is called. The chair of the board is John Boehner. Mm-hmm. And the president, the CEO of the company is Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And the board is having a discussion saying this just isn't working. What does that business do?
Well, if I were the CEO, I would go to my employees and my other stakeholders, including institutional investors and even, individual investors who now increasingly have a role here, mm-hmm. like a citizenship role to play in corporate governance. And I would talk about what's really at stake. Okay, so we have the immediacy of financial chaos and arguably disaster, not just for the United States, but for a lot of the world.
No
right?
one understands. I'm sorry. I don't know anybody who understands
what
understand
that means. I don't
understand either. We can all recite the words.
Shall I say
default.
It? Shall
yeah,
I
sure.
Say it?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's what's happening. The debt ceiling is a constitutional requirement that was created in the 14th Amendment. It was created in the aftermath of the Civil War to make sure that American, U.S. federal debt, right, wasn't watered down and Confederate debt wasn't allowed to repay government debts. A lot of those bonds, by the way, were held by widows and pensioners, right, from the Civil War, created as a constitutional requirement to make sure Congress stayed on the debt, right? It basically is like calling up your MasterCard 800 number and saying, right, I need to extend my credit limit. I need to raise my credit limit. I've already spent the money, and I need, instead of $4,000, I need $5,000. I need a higher ceiling on money I have already spent. And there are a lot of other people depending on me, right, to get that ceiling, because I have, if you're the United States government, issued a lot of pieces of paper called Treasury bills that say, I can't pay you today, but I will pay you in 5 years this amount printed on this bill. Who holds those bills? All kinds of people, not just American widows and orphans, but Chinese governments, right? Banks all over the world, state, municipal, and retirement funds. So those pieces of paper, money the American government has already spent by putting it on its MasterCard, are the credit of the entire world economy.
But what does that mean for me, what they would say, Professor Kane? I hear that, and intellectually that means something to me. But as an individual working two jobs, trying to keep my family afloat, why do I care if my country, even other than the embarrassment, why do I care if it defaults on its obligations? How does it affect me?
Well, if you have any kind of government payment from anywhere, even if you're like my mother, a librarian, retired librarian from the city of Bloomington, Illinois, it's likely that your checks now will get may not be able to be paid, even though they're from the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund. Why? Because the state gets a lot of money from the federal government to pay its other bills. So it's like turning off the spigot at a bank. And now suddenly all kinds of things, not just federal payments to Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, food stamps, every other kind of payment that the federal government makes to you and I, to thou and I, it's not just turning those payments off. It's the chain reaction of once the federal government can't write any more checks that they pay for with debt because the U.S. elected Congress elected to do that. Remember, we've already elected democratically to spend the money. It is spent, right? And now we're saying, oops, we're going to default on this. All kinds of pipes will suddenly close, right? And that will very, very quickly create, you know, a lot less money, what we call liquidity in the system. It's entirely possible we will have something on the order of what happened in September of 2008 when the financial system ground almost to a halt, not just in Bloomington, Illinois, not just in Waltham, Massachusetts, not just, right, in Worcester, but all over the planet.
That was cheerful.
I'm persuaded.
Okay. Okay.
Let's not default.
Let's move on.
That is why, right, Christine Lagarde at the IMF.
Yeah, they're in a panic.
That's why I love this line from quote in the Times yesterday from the Chinese government. It's time for the rest of the world to start planning for an un-Americanized global system. Because guess what? The cop, right, in charge of all this is asleep and kind of losing his marbles or her marbles.
Well, that's the other thing, too, that people are going to lose faith around the world in our, obviously, ability to get our act together.
Yeah, but see, that doesn't do – I mean, that may do something for those who are in the business. That's exactly
what I'm
speaking to Nancy.
Trust me, every single American will feel the effects of this within 2 weeks.
But that is, I think, your underlying point at the beginning is that's what's got to be explained, picture.
But we're also so heavily in debt to China. I, you know, they have to believe we're going to pay them back.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's a big thing. This
is $1.3 trillion.
Yeah.
We're playing with real fire.
Yeah,
we are
playing with real fire. But let's move on to something
more cheerful.
Well, it's not that cheerful, but we can certainly relate to this because you've written a lot about bad meetings and good meetings. You cite this great survey out of University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School where the average senior executive spends 100 hours a month in meetings. But these senior executives and the middle managers say about half of these meetings are totally useless, and almost everybody in those meetings is daydreaming.
Or taking other work to do, or pretending to pay attention, but not.
Exactly. Yet we persist in these meetings. Everybody can relate to them, and you have some suggestions.
Well, before you do, 11 million formal meetings every day in this
country?
Something like 11 million?
Yeah, 11 million. 4 billion a year, half of which probably are considered pretty unconstructive.
Okay, right. Give us a few of your 8 tips, Nancy Kane, about how to improve one's meeting skills and meetings.
All right, well, let's start at the end. So put your smartphones, if you're the leader of the meeting, in the front, very, very pointedly, in the middle of the table at the front of the room. So that everyone has to follow suit.
Even if you don't say it, they will follow
suit. Oh, yeah. It's called you know, like the phone stack. It's kind of becoming a new thing in New York restaurants to show that you're actually not so, you know, kind of gauche as to take phone calls during a meeting.
Or text.
Stack your phone.
People are texting like crazy all the time at meetings.
So if we put all our phones in the center, that immediately eliminates a lot of distraction and creates, by virtue of doing it, a lot more mutual respect in the meeting, right? It also focuses some energy. So that's the first thing. Second thing is I'm a real believer in you got to have some food and drink. I think the stupidest thing that companies do when they get budget crunch, it's also one of the first things, is cut the free coffee. Right? And donuts or free coffee and fruit. People need to eat and gather around eating and get refreshed and have that caring bestowed on them in order to stay focused in meetings that no one wants to go to.
I want to come to your meetings.
Thirdly, you got to start and end on time. Just think about this for a second. It
Huge.
Sounds so obvious.
Absolutely.
But think about it. If you start starting late, then first of all, everyone starts coming late. It means that just like a therapy session, you know when you go into therapy and you don't actually say the really big thing on your mind until the last 5 minutes because you're so nervous about it? Meetings are like that. The big important stuff keeps getting pushed off. So if you start late and end late, you are so much less likely to get to the really important stuff. So that is really important. Not to mention the fact that once you start this cycle of late beginnings and late endings, everyone in the whole organization starts running late. And everyone outside them that's trying to meet with people that are in late meetings starts, you know, spinning their wheels and being frustrated. Fourth, consider actually not having a meeting. I think one of the reasons there are so many lousy meetings is that we kind of get in this habit, like, let's have a meeting about that, right? And email really facilitates this because you can just keep sending stuff out to some kind of listserv and eventually we'll all gather. But what if you actually walk over to someone's desk and actually have a conversation with them, right? Or consider one of the things that all these executives surveyed say is a phone call could dispense with, could do the work of about half the meetings they go to. So, and that means, by the way, we're going to have fewer people involved because most meetings have too many people. Yeah. I like to say, think of a meeting as a dinner party, right?
That's a great analogy.
Right? You wouldn't cook, clean, you know, shop and prepare your table for people you don't like or you don't think are going to provide interesting conversation and good energy.
Yeah.
Think of a meeting that way. Who's essential, right? Fifth.
I'm not laughing at you. I just want to say, as you're speaking, I'm looking at the pieces you've written and some of the numbers. 91% of attendees daydream during.
Yeah.
It's just great.
I love this line. The great white collar crime is the meeting wastes $37 billion a year.
Yeah, and okay. That number's very old.
Number five.
Okay, so it's up to $100 billion by now.
Yeah.
What's number five?
Number five is, send out an agenda with only three things on it. Don't send out like every single piece of paper, right? You know, reply all, you know, listserv to everyone. Because one of the things that happens with meetings is you end up with this huge stack of documents in your inbox, none of which, you know, which you don't know which of which is important. And that actually kind of tends to make all of us kind of our eyes glaze over and our appetite for the meeting or the topic or the initiative diminish. So an agenda, 3 points max. No one can remember more than three things anyway. Send it out 24 hours ahead of time. And then when you get into the meeting, say, repeat those three things because we all need to have things repeated so much because we're so fractured and our attention spans are so short. And then begin with those three things and the ultimate intention of the meeting. I got this actually from Oprah Winfrey many years ago when I did a case on her. She used to say, I never go into the studio without going down the elevator and asking myself, what is the intention of this segment I'm about to make?
Ah, God, Jim, remember that. That's important.
What is the intention?
The intention of the segment.
If you say, welcome, here is our intention, I guarantee, I've watched this happen. I've worked with people on this. A lot of the coaching I do to pay for my horse and clothes habit is, you know, is around this stuff. I've watched people do this. Here's the intention. Suddenly people are like, oh my goodness, this is new and different. Phones are in the center of the table and we have an intention. That can, again, shift the group's energy real fast, and it really ups the probability that you're going to get something good coming out of that gathering.
You know, it's one, you know,
intention of the segment.
I occasionally think about what the intention of the segment
is.
Not
do.
Every day.
Thank God you're here, Jim.
You know, Nancy Kane, not to belittle these suggestions, this is sort of analogous to the conversation we were having about Washington leadership and the shutdown default mess. These are so obvious to me that the fact that people are not respectful enough to start meetings on time or end them in relatively short order, the fact that they don't think, you're right, if you're taken away from your work for 90 minutes, you maybe should have a cup of coffee or something so you don't pass out. Why is it because of the only thing I can think of is the hierarchy in American workplaces has become so intense, the division between the top and the bottom has become so intense that it's sort of this notion that I have a right to do whatever I want, however I want. Is that the explanation for this? What's the genesis?
Well, you know, I think it's a couple of things. One, I think that we've just gotten as a society a bit more rude, a little bit less graceful, a little less courteous, a little less thoughtful of ourselves and of others, right? I mean, you know, if I could create, you know, an app, it would be kind of Emily Post, right, for this moment. There's something that people, you know, all kinds of people would be able to put on their smartphones and go, hey, this makes sense. This is going to make my life a little bit better if I say please and thank you. So part of it is we're just a little bit more rude than we need to be, and we're not thinking enough because we think that the answer lies in this technology and in our relationship with our illicit lovers called smartphones. I think that's part of it. There's something else going on, too, and that is that, and you'll forgive the slightly kind of whingy historical harumphy note to this. I think that honestly we don't have enough nurturing and kind of maternal, if you will, or just plain old common sense in corporate America. Plain old common sense is, yeah, we have coffee. Yeah, we have water. Yeah, it's going to be 60 minute stops. You know, I keep thinking about mothers and how much triaging and how many meetings they actually end up hosting every day if you're dealing with kids and PTA and, you know, busy families and a, you know, cranky partner, right? And the precariousness of life right now and health and aging parents. Women, mothers are incredibly good meeting managers, right? And they get through all kinds of stuff all the time. And I think we just need some more pure, practical, on-the-street common sense in corporate America. I'm really struck by this, being a member of several different boards. But I think there's a third thing as well, and that is that we've lost the appreciation of, I mean, you were just talking about home economics,
yes,
right? We've lost these very basic kind of skills, life skills. And so we can wring our hands that they're gone, or we can say, hey, let's think of a way to rediscover them and re, you know, kind of reproclaim them for this moment. That is what we have to be doing, because we're just going to have to do it, because we can't boil water, we don't know how to say please and thank you, and we don't know how to start and end a meeting on time. It's sad, but it's true. Let's let that go, and let's get on trying to change things.
Now, Nancy Kane, I would love to continue this conversation, but we agreed this meeting would end at 1:25. And in the new spirit of the Jim and Marjorie experience, Nancy, it was great to see you, and the cookies are fabulous. Thank you.
Yeah. My pleasure.
Nancy Kane.
Nancy Kane will be joining us on Tuesdays for Open Mic. Every Tuesday, she's a historian at Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E.
Robeson
Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Thank you so much, Nancy. That was great. Intention of the meeting, Jim. I wrote that down. Intention of the segment, excuse me. We're right back. That's why I'm in trouble. You see, I can't remember. Intention of the segment. When we came back, we're going to explore how women in 2013 are faring. A recent study says 41% of women in the United States live in poverty. How can this be? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
A young woman in Turkey started a vineyard and she made wine. Yes, you can do that in modern Turkey.
I'm a Muslim. I'm a winemaker, but it's not a conflict thing.
Well, it wasn't a conflict. Companies can make wine, you can drink it, but now no one can promote it. Turkey's advertising ban on booze, plus how a debt crisis took down the Spanish Empire. That's next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Benjamin Zander, performing Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony and Prokofiev's Second Piano Concerto with soloist Ju Wong, October 24th, 25th, and 27th, bostonphil.org. And the Providence Country Day School, where students accept the challenge to reap experience, confidence, and independence. Open house on Saturday, October 26th, 10 to 12. Information at providencecountryday.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie. And last month, you remember we talked about how almost 50% of women in the U.S. fear they will become bag ladies. Joining us in Studio 3 to explain why women have these fears are Carol Rivers and Roz Barnett. Their new book is The New Soft War on Women, How the Myth of Female Ascendance is Hurting Women, Men, and Our Economy. It's great to see you both. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Thank you very much for coming in, ladies. So the message used to be, is you point out, okay, girls, women, you can't do it, forget it, you can't want to do these things. But the message now has changed to something that's not really all that great. What is the new message in 2013?
Well, one of the messages is that men are failing, the end of men, women are the richer sex, and sort of the sub rosa message is women step back. You're just doing too well and you're making men fail. And this is all garbage, because what we're really finding is that high and low, women are stalling in the workplace. They're doing great in universities, getting more degrees, but in the workplace, they're stalling out.
What is stalling how? What does that mean, Rosa? What does stalling mean?
That men are stalling out?
No. The women are stalling in the workplace. What does that mean?
Well, if you take a look at the number of women that are in CEO positions, top positions, that number is not growing. In fact, some people see it as declining. Eileen Lang, who was CEO of Catalyst, she looking at some data, she said if the lines, trend lines for women in CEO positions with a person's pulse, they'd be dead. This is flatlining. So the women are just bumping up over and over again to the glass ceiling is a trite now phrase, but that's what it seems like. They get so far, but they don't get further.
And Carol Rivers, the title, The New Software on Women, is the point that it used to be much more overt, and now it's this software, so to speak, that causes women to be in the position you and Roz are describing, is a more subtle sort of sub rosa kind of thing. Is that what it is?
Very much so. And we call it the soft war on women. Harvard Business Review calls it second-generation discrimination. So we all thought discrimination went away. What happened was it went underground. People still have these stereotypes and these ideas, but they don't say them anymore. But they think them. And men and women both do. And it affects hiring, promotion, all kinds of things that keep women sort of anchored, stuck in the mud.
Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I think a lot of us found out, because a lot of the early feminists, except for Betty Friedan, didn't have any kids. And kids, someone does have to raise the kids. So that a lot of these women that do get these advanced degrees, unless they're the Sheryl Sandberg that, you know, is loaded with money, they get out, they have the kids, and they decide themselves they do not want to work 80 hours a week, and a lot of these super-duper jobs require these very long schedules. So aren't they sometimes self-selecting, saying, I don't want to do this anymore?
Well, maybe some of that, but I think what's not the story that's not told is how many women are working in high-pressure jobs and do have children. I mean, the media story is all about the women who, you know, don't have children or they drop out. But we did some look-up stuff and found that the number of women CEOs in major companies who have 3 and 4 children. That's a story that no one tells.
Yeah.
It is possible to do this. Not everybody would want to, men and women, but there's certainly not the case that just by having children, you kind of precludes you from having a high-level job because there are just too many people like that.
But who's raising the kids? I guess that's the thing, because you can't be working. If you're a high-level CEO, you're probably not working a 30-hour-a-week job. You're probably working much more than that,
well,
right?
Well, for one thing, they're two parents.
Yeah.
And men are doing more, and a lot of men are doing a lot more. You know, and they probably have help as well. But, you know, it depends on the age of the kids, I guess. But I was really, myself, very surprised at how many women are in this position of having not tiny families, you know, one child, but substantial families.
Carol Rivers, can we bring it back to Massachusetts specific for a second? I've been asking this question of virtually every woman candidate for virtually any executive office in Massachusetts since I started doing this 15 years ago. We are allegedly one of the one or two most progressive states in America, and we have, I don't have the stats in front of me, about as poor a record of electing women to leadership positions in government. I mean, sort of Elizabeth Warren sort of broke that proverbial glass ceiling, I guess, a couple of years ago. I know you've written about that race in particular.
Yes.
Does the soft war, new soft war on women, explain why women have gotten not so far in Massachusetts politics?
Yeah, I think there's several things. We know, for one thing, that women don't get the same kind of credit that men do when they have achievements. Men often get the credit that that women should have. We know that, particularly in politics, and this shocked me, if a woman speaks at length, she is considered gabby and incompetent. If a man speaks at length, he is considered forceful and worthy of praise. So,
there's research that supports that, or that's anecdotal?
No, this is absolutely Yale University research. And one researcher went to the U.S. Senate and found, that's where she found this, first found this, that, so here you are, if you're a woman and you're a candidate, and if you, you know, talk too long, and of course, what do you do as a candidate day after day after day? You speak, you're not given the same, you know, kind of appreciation as a man. So,
but why is it worse here than it is in so many? I mean, we are really at the bottom of the proverbial barrel, it
right.
seems to me. Why is it aberrationally horrible here? I understand your general point.
Right.
Why is it so bad in Massachusetts?
Well, I think because we're a political state, you know, going way back to James Michael Curley and, politics has been an industry here in Massachusetts. In a lot of other states, people don't want to go into politics. You can't get anybody to run for the school board or the local, you know, any local office. Here, you've got 10 people lining up because they're thinking, I get this town meeting and then I'll be Ted Kennedy, you know?
Aren't too many Ted Kennedys.
Tell us about your analysis of the coverage. It was is fascinating, of the Scott Brown versus Elizabeth Warren race. You have a whole chapter about that in the New Soft War on Women. What was your impressions, either of you, Roz or Carol?
Well, one thing that really interested me was the way in which Elizabeth Warren was presented as hectoring, shaking her finger, you know, lecturing to people, hey, professor. Now, if her name had been Professor John Warren, do you think she would have gotten the same kind of coverage? I doubt it. So you saw, I think you saw tons of sexist coverage of Elizabeth Warren. Fortunately for Warren, Scott Brown did not run a good campaign this time.
But Rosalind Barton, I'm sorry. People pointed that out, too. I mean, I know I did, and I know Joan Vernacki did in The Globe, and I'm sure people did it on television, pointed out the professor. So it wasn't like it went unchallenged. Mm-hmm. You know, and we also called her in the Herald Granny, which I didn't like much either, mm-hmm. and people did point that out. You know what I mean?
But, you know, the difference is that women start out with those issues. Your dress is looked at. Your speech is looked at. Yep. All these things are looked at. When's the last time you really heard about what a man wore?
Well, I'll give you a good example. It's funny you say that. I would argue in that exact same race that the way Scott Brown was talked about from his cosmopolitan centerfold to the photographs of him running shirtless in triathlons. Now, admittedly, he put it in his own book, but whatever. I mean, can you imagine the same things being said about a woman and her physique, as were said about Brown and his?
Well, I think in that case, Scott Brown made that an issue. A lot of women don't make it an issue, but it's made an issue for them by the media. And often it's very hard for women to get their message out because those other issues are, you know, the noise gets to be too loud.
And I think that's really an anomaly. I mean, Scott Brown,
I agree with that.
You know, how many people pose for, you know, Playgirl? In almost all the male races we talk about, rarely is the man's physique even discussed.
Yeah. You know what I find fascinating, too, though, and there's been a lot of talk about this, and you guys have addressed it as well, the over-sexualization of women you see, particularly in the media. I mean, everybody on television, even Lara Logan on 60 Minutes Cleavage, I mean, she's a serious journalist. You see very sexy outfits of women on television. So on the one hand, you say to yourself, I don't like that. On the other hand, you don't see women who dress in a provocative way, a sexy way, necessarily dismissed as dummies like you did 30 years ago if women dressed like that. So it's almost a double-edged sword.
Well, don't forget Hillary Clinton. When she ran for president, and she showed some cleavage a little bit, and she was just, you know, taken to the barn for that.
But no one thinks she's a dumb woman because she dressed like that.
No.
So in some ways, it's almost a backwards kind of progress that... When I was young, if you showed up with cleavage at the office in the 70s or 80s, you'd be dismissed as some sort of airhead.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can run around in cleavage and short skirts and tight dresses and be credited as having a brain. So that's progress, isn't it?
But you can't get a job when you're 45 as a television anchor, probably unless you've had a facelift. So, we've advanced in some ways. You can be pretty, but you have to really be look like you're 22.
We call those head transplants, Carol Rivers, to be more precise. So, we are great at identifying problems, Marjorie and I, on Boston Public Radio. We're not quite as good at solving them. So you identify a problem, Rosalind Barnett and Carol Rivers, in the new software on women. Ross, starting with you.
Yeah.
So what is the real-world solution for the good guys, for lack of a better expression, to win the new soft war on women?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's one solution. And I mean, plenty of books that say, well, do this and do that, and the problem will take care of itself. So we propose a three-pronged solution.
What's that?
First is the individual. What can women themselves do? And we have some points in there. For one thing, the stereotype about women is not very flattering in business world. So you don't want the stereotype to define you. So you go to a meeting, whatever, you have someone introduce you with all your credentials and your background, so you're being seen as a competent person, offsetting the negative, incompetent stereotype of women. So there are things at an individual level that women can do. Secondly, at the company level, there are things that need to be done.
Like what?
Like one is to educate managers about what gender discrimination is really all about. Because it's so much ingrained that we don't even are insensitive to it. And it's important for managers to learn this because they're in charge of hiring and firing and promotions. And the bottom line is really a function of bringing talent to people along. And we know from plenty of research that companies where women with a better gender balance at the high levels are more productive companies. So companies should have an investment in making sure that it happens. The third level is the federal government level. If you had, you know, child care policies and you had health care policies, and you had policies to help women pay maternity leave, pay parental leave, that would help women an awful lot because they have to struggle with those issues on top of everything else that they are confronted with.
You know, one thing that women we talked to, we heard over and over again the same story. I was working with a guy and he got all the credit. I went to my bosses. They only talked to him. They emailed him. They didn't talk to me. So one of the things that we find is that women have to realize you're going to be judged as woman, capital W. So unlike a man, you've got to go in there and put your credentials on the table. You've got to tell people what you can do. And, of course, you risk being disliked because there's also research showing that the more competent women are, the more unlikable they're seen as. So you're in this box. It's really difficult.
Before you both go, I introduced you mentioning a discussion we had about a month ago here. When Marjorie called me, or it was Chelsea, I'm not sure, and mentioned this story, I said it can't be true. This research that showed that somewhere in the neighborhood of the high 40% of adult American women believe they could become bag ladies. And when I first read that, I said, God, it's got to be the lowest income people. 20-some percent of women from families making more than 200 grand a year also believe they could become bag ladies. Roz Barnett, does that fit in? Does that fear fit into what you're writing about here? Does that surprise you at all?
Well, it's surprising. I'd like to know more about the study, but I guess on the surface, my first reaction is that women's success is very precarious. We know from some work we reported in the book that for women in certain occupations, unlike men, if they screw up and make a mistake, they're out. Where men make a mistake and they dust it off and they get supports a group around them, they say, oh, you know, this guy's got a lot of potential. We'll keep him around for a while. So women's success is much more precarious than men's.
And there's something called the glass cliff. Very often, women get promoted to the top job when everything's falling apart. So, okay, things are falling apart, put a woman on, and of course she fails, and then she's never hired again because she failed. So I don't think that's unusual at all. I think now, today, with the sequester and the government shutdown, I can see a lot of women who are working at good salaries who are saying, I am one pink slip away from being that bag lady.
So leave us with an up note. We're in a very positive mode, or we're not in a positive mode.
Think we're in the middle somewhere.
Give us one good example of progress that has happened that appears not to be ephemeral. Kyle Rivers, Roz Barnett, either of you? There's a long silence notice in the studio.
Well, certainly women are doing wonderfully well in universities. I mean, they're making all kinds of degrees, are going into fields they've never gone into before. So we've made a tremendous amount of headway that way. And there's obviously more work to do. But I think women, even though the road is hard, are slogging it out. They're sticking with it. And we're making pride.
And I think there is goodwill. I mean, I think 90% of companies have diversity programs on their books. The problem is they don't work because there's not real commitment. But I think if you tell these people that and you say, look, you've got to make this stuff work, I think there are both men and women out there who care and who will say, yeah, we got to make this work.
Fair enough.
Thank you very much for coming in, both Carol and Roz. Carol Rivers is a professor of journalism at Boston University's College of Communication. Roz Barnett is a senior scientist at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis. Their book is The New Soft War on Women. Great chapter in there, too, about Larry Summers, the former president of Harvard, and his different travails in this area. Thank you again for being here.
When we come back,
we're going to look at the mayoral race with a focus on some endorsements that really do matter in this election. That conversation is next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Six months after the Boston Marathon bombings, there were three deaths and dozens of amputations from the two bombs on Boylston Street, another fatality, and more gunshot victims from the Cambridge car chase and Watertown shootout. But there are many more unanswered questions, including an unsolved triple murder in Waltham. I'm reporter Philip Martin. Join us for a focus on the Boston Marathon bombings 6 months later, this week at 7 o'clock on WGBH2's Greater Boston.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru Forester with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at subaruofnewengland.com. An Orchestra of Indian Hill, Maestro Bruce Hangen opens the season with an all-Beethoven program featuring Symphony No. 7 and the Piano Concerto No. 4. October 19th in Littleton, indianhillmusic.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Last week, John Connolly and Martin Walsh got some, I never called him Martin before, Marty Walsh got some endorsements that really do matter in this race. Over the weekend, mayoral candidate Charlotte Guller Ritchie threw her support behind Marty Walsh.
I'm supporting Marty because I feel that he is going to fulfill my desire and the desire of my supporters to bring positive change to all of the neighborhoods of the city of Boston.
And at roughly the same time, a handful of Boston's black ministers, including the Reverend Minyard Culpepper, is in studio with us, threw their support behind John Connolly.
It's important that we elect somebody that has made a commitment to not only diversify his staff, but the police department, the fire department, and someone that's committed to make a change at BRA to deal with some of the economic disparities in this city.
Joining us to talk about their candidates of choice, by the way, on the day of the first of three debates, the second one Marjorie and I will be moderating on GBH TV and radio, are Reverend Minyard Culpepper. He's in the studio, and Charlotte Guller Ritchie's on the phone. Thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you both for coming in as well.
Charlotte, you're there, right?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Charlotte. Sorry, I just want to make sure you're there.
So let's start with the Reverend because he's in the studio here. So why do you think that John Connolly is going to be better about, you know, the BRA, about diversity on his staff and schools? Why is he going to be better for the city of Boston than Marty Walsh, Reverend?
Well, you mentioned schools. I think, and John and I have not always agreed on how to approach improving the quality of schools in Boston, but we do agree that the Boston schools can be one of the best and a model, a showcase for the nation. You know, we had our differences in the past over the superintendent.
Right.
Carol Johnson.
We came together.
He was very tough on the superintendent.
That's right, and I was tough on him.
Yeah.
And he came by, and we sat, talked about it, and I asked him not to pursue asking Carol Johnson to resign anymore, convinced him to withdraw that position and not pursue it. He agreed. And so he convinced me that he would be the best one to change the Boston schools into a model school system. Now, I think working hand in hand for me and for the community that I serve, we were raised being told and taught that education is the key to any progress and development. I think education in our community is the key to jobs. I think it's the key to the young folks that are not even graduating now. Quality schools will make the difference. And so I'm supporting John because I think he's going to be the education mayor. He's fought for it for years. He's focused on it for years. And he's still pressing to make all of the schools quality schools in the city of Boston. The
Reverend Culpepper, before you go ahead 1 second, and we're going to get to Charlotte Guller Ritchie in a second. There were reports, not reports, in the statement, Pastor Dickerson was with you and some others at the time of the endorsement, and what Pastor Dickerson said and subsequently said was a misstatement, is that Connolly had committed specifically to you, that you and Pastor Dickerson, that he would pick a superintendent and a police chief of color. Is that, and
well,
later...
Let me just correct that, Jim. If you... I read that article when they asked me. I said I wasn't in that meeting.
No, I know, but Pastor Dickerson is the one that said it, I'm saying. About. And he subsequently stepped back from that. So
what I've said and what John said to me is that he is committed and he will ensure that we will have a diverse city leadership. Now, if it comes to the superintendent and the police commissioner, fire commissioner, all of the positions, if... we have the candidates that are best suited for that position, and they are African-American or minority, he'll appoint them. He has no problems with appointing African-American and or minority leadership.
Okay, Charlotte Guller Ritchie, sorry, but on the phone sometimes forgotten and not forgotten in this case. Why is Marty Walsh the best candidate according to you, Felix Arroyo, John Barros, the three top vote-getting people of color in the mayor's race?
For a number of reasons. I mean, he, too, has made a concrete commitment to diversity in his administration. And I just want to say, you know, Reverend Culpepper and I are friends, and he supported my campaign. And, you know, sorry that we're not on the same side on this. But, you know, I think we have, just like he is, ensuring that his candidate will live up to certain promises. I know that I'm not going to be alone in saying that candidate Marty Walsh is going to also do the same. So at the very least, 50% of the cabinet will be people of color. I think he's going to work hard to make sure that that will extend across all in terms of all agency heads. But it's more than that. I mean, you were talking about education. You know, Marty cares very much about education. You know, he helped to start a charter school in Dorchester, but he has also made a very solid commitment to make sure that our public schools remain, you know, the essential resource that they are, because we know that oftentimes they're the only option that our children are going to have to get an education in the city of Boston. So he's going to push for autonomy at the central office on Court Street. He's going to push to make sure that the facilities, the school facilities, are repaired and are, you know, brought up to par, and that, you know, there are going to be enrichment programs like art programs at every school, and he will push for lower class sizes and make sure that we've got the equipment and the books and materials there that students need to learn. And I'm sure he's going to hire an excellent school superintendent. But let me just say that both candidates are going to make, you know, all sorts of promises, right?
Right.
Jim and Marjorie, they'll make all kinds of promises. I think when it comes down to it, his question is, how do you know and what guarantees do you have that all that's promised will be lived up to? And I'm just going to say that I know Marty over almost, I would say, 20 years. He endorsed me when I ran for office back in 1994, so I've known him that long.
And he lives near you.
Yes, he does. So yeah. I've seen him in the neighborhoods. I've seen him up at Beacon Hill. I've seen him in different venues.
Yep.
But the other thing I want to add is it's not just me, Marjorie, and Jim. It's also the fact that Marty has successfully pulled together a diverse coalition of supporters. You saw that my endorsement was last Saturday, but also he had these different progressive groups, including OISTE,
yep.
The Latino organization that focuses on, you know, statewide organization that focuses on policy and all
Charlotte,
that.
Just, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we just have a little time, and I want to get back to Reverend Culpepper. But before we do, that you know, you've heard this, the rumor around town, Charlotte Gorla Ritchie, that one of the reasons you were after John Barros and after Felix Arroyo in announcing your support for Marty Walsh is because Tom Menino was on your back to support John Conley, and that he was trying to persuade you, even though he claims publicly that he's neutral. Any truth to that, Charlotte Gorla Ritchie?
So I have not talked to the mayor, and so I would have to say I don't know where that's coming from. There, John Connolly, to his credit, tried very hard to get my endorsement. Okay, so John Connolly worked to get my endorsement, and I did not see him having any ambassador from City Hall trying to get. To get my endorsement for John Connolly.
Okay.
Hey,
Can I just say the reason it took as long as it did is because I did not want my endorsement to be about it just a leap of faith.
Okay.
Wanted to make sure it was accompanied by tangible commitments to the issues that my supporters and I care about, and I'm convinced that that's what's happened in the last week.
Reverend Culpepper, the question is actually for both of you. In the wake of the election, immediately after the preliminary, and we're in a majority and minority city, as you both know and as our listeners know, there were pieces written about how if the communities of color had come together, rallied around one candidate, he or she probably would have been in the final. Peter Galzinis actually did the math in the Boston Herald. There was a meeting that was pulled together to try to rally people, and then virtually everybody tried to distance himself from this. Are we not encountering the same fracturing of the leaders in communities of color again? Some of the black ministers led by you and Pastor Dickerson with John Connolly. I mentioned Arroyo, Barros, and Gorla Ritchie with Marty Walsh. Isn't there the potential for the influence that everybody said was going to be huge in communities of color to be canceled out as a result of this?
I wouldn't say canceled out. I think, you know, just like any other community, the minority community is not a monolithic
Understood.
Community. I think that when you look at these candidates, it's interesting, though, that the elected officials kind of went with Marty Walsh and the ministers. Let me just say this, and let's be transparent. The unions have not been the friend of minorities in our community for years. When you look at the Boston Police and Mamleo, how they're fighting to get Boston Police in.
That's the Association of Minority Officers, by
right.
the way. Yeah.
They're trying to get more police officers in. That, well, there was that consent decree that had certain requirements years ago, that it was the union that went in to terminate that consent decree. And when you look at the Carpenters Workers Union, I think Marty Walsh is a good guy. I walked with him through the community. I think he's a good guy. But I think when you look at the support from the unions, I mean, you've got unions from Virginia tweeting into the state. This is really a Boston election.
I want Charlotte to respond to that because we only have 3 minutes, Reverend.
Okay. No, go ahead. I'm not finished, though.
No, I got you, but we want to get everybody in. Charlotte, how do you respond to what the Reverend is saying?
So I know that there have been concerns expressed about Marty's union affiliation, and I would say this, that I think Reverend Culpepper and I would agree that we support working families, and unions are about advocating for working families. And Marty, when he becomes mayor and he heads to the negotiating table, he's going to head there with at least a level of trust and respect that is going to be important. Now, I have managed in a union environment, okay? I headed up the Department of Neighborhood Development that had a union there. And I can tell you that the negotiating process is eased considerably when you have people at the table who feel that they are negotiating in good faith. And I think that's what we're going to get with Marty.
But you don't feel that way, Reverend Culpepper. You feel that the better deal for the working families will come from John Conley.
Absolutely. I think the government opens up. You don't have the same pressure that you're going to have from the unions and the same connection. I saw in the Herald this morning, and I'm not criticizing Marty Walsh, but I saw where he got $371,000 from the unions.
Right.
How can you not, when you're in that kind of situations with the union, not favor the unions? We're willing, and that's why the minister stood up for Conley, that we are standing up saying that we want an open government that's not one that's going to be pressured and in some ways controlled by the union, all the way with tweets from Virginia and now ads on. The final thing I want to say is one of the reasons why I looked at John Conley real close is he had this school group that were putting $500,000 into the election.
Yeah, Stanford Children.
I was upset about
right.
that. But when John Conley decided that he wasn't going to take that $500,000 pledge, it made me feel a lot better about John Conley. I think this needs to be an election where Bostonians decide the election, not with outside influence.
Hey, Charlotte Culler-Rich, we only have 45 seconds left. I'd love you to respond quickly, if you can, to the same question I asked Reverend Culpepper about the division. I'm not suggesting any community is a monolith, but aren't we experiencing deja vu all over again, to quote Yogi Berra in Communities of Color, with the politicians, the three of you in particular, on one side, and some of the ministers on the other?
So I'm told that there are a number of members of the clergy who will be coming out to endorse Marty. So I think that you are going to see, you're going to see many more people coming out over the course of the rest of the campaign, coming out in support of Marty. And I think that because of his stand in support of working families. And I just want to say, so John has talent and he has a great message and a vision for the city. So this is not to degrade what he's doing, but Marty has very, very deep roots over the course of his career. He has worked with diverse communities, and that's why you're seeing people come out in support of him. I know Marty personally, and so do other people. And that's, what about. It's about people connecting with the person they know on a personal level. That's
Charlotte,
why Marty...
Charlotte, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are almost out of time, and I want to thank you very much for calling into us, though, Charlotte Culler-Ritchie, okay?
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Charlotte Culler-Ritchie has endorsed Martin Walsh, the Reverend Minyard Culpepper, who's here with the studio. He and other ministers is backing John Conley.
Reverend,
thanks again.
Thank you for being with us.
And thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Ask the Secretary. That would be Secretary of Transportation Richard Davey. We're also going to talk about the mayor's race tonight, go over it with Peter Katz, the mayor's race debate tonight. Peter Katz and David Bernstein will talk about it tomorrow.
I'm Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. See you tomorrow.